This is the Beat Your Genes podcast, and my name is Nate G. I created this podcast to bridge together the science of evolutionary psychology and the clinical experience of Dr. Doug Lyle, all so that we can discover what life is all about. In each episode, Dr. Lyle analyzes and explains the psychology behind real-life situations from our listeners on topics like romance, friendship, work, family, health, and many more. We broadcast live every Wednesday at 8:30 p.m. Pacific Standard Time, which means you can call us during the show and ask Dr. Lyle a question. The U.S. number is 657-383-0751, or send in your question through the website www.beatyourgenes.org.
All right. Good evening, everybody. This is Nate G. Dr. Lyle, how are you doing today?
Good, good. How you doing?
Not too bad. You know, I was reading a couple of articles this week for the Journal of Evolutionary Psychology, and one of them really just kind of struck my fancy. It was called, "What if your rival drives a Porsche?"
So, that's beautiful.
Yeah. I mean, I've never owned a Porsche. I think there was an ongoing joke when I was in junior high, right? Well, what's the difference between a cactus and a Porsche? Right.
It's
on the cactus, the prick is on the outside.
very good.
I've met people who are fine people who own Porsche.
Yeah.
But the purpose of the study, though, wasn't to determine who's a prick and who's not a prick. They were trying to figure out just how these displays of what they call conspicuous consumption affects rivals. Because as you've said on the program before, as we delve into evolutionary psychology, we see that males will buy luxury products and then they'll show them off to signal their mate value and attract a mate.
Right.
And so they've had research on this, but they wanted to know what effect that this type of conspicuous consumption has on other males. And it turns out in this particular study, this was called Luxury Car Spending as a Costly Signal in Male Intrasexual Competition. Mm-hmm. What they found was that men perceived the guy who does this, who displayed this conspicuous consumption of in the particular case, a luxury car, they perceived him more as a rival and a mate poacher and less as a friend compared to the men who didn't display displayed a non-luxury car.
Right.
And interesting, because what they also did was they found that men rated the guy who displays with a luxury car. They also rated him higher for attractiveness, higher for sexual willingness, higher for intelligence, higher for ambition and status, which actually suggests in this study that a man who displays these type of luxuries can actually have an advantage over other men, as he could deter any inferior rivals from competing with him.
Right. All very good. This is goes down directly with costly signaling theory, and that's exactly how that should work. Yeah. This also explains my recent dating failure that I had. So I go out with this gal, obviously. She's in her late 40s. I'm older, and I thought it was actually going very well. And so she's very interested in what it is that I had to say. And this, through no fault of my own, truly, this goes on for 3.5 hours. And so I'm explaining everything under the sun, and she's taking notes, and I'm explaining things, and we're going through the big five, and it's all highly entertaining. And then I explain that what we do in our consumption, in consumer behavior, is we are using consumer goods to signal the big five. So we talk about that, and then I guessed what kind of car she had. And I was pretty close. I guessed that I said,
"That's really good."
I said it would be a little bit exotic and intelligent, signaling intelligence and some degree of openness, but not too open, because there's a reasonable amount of conventionality there. So I said it's not likely to be a United States model car. It's likely to be foreign. It's probably European. We want to signal a little bit of suave there. And she wouldn't have got something as flashy as a Lexus, nor as tightly controlled probably as an Acura, but it would have been higher good. So I said possibly an Audi or a Saab, okay? And it turned out it was a Volvo. But she hastened to explain to me that it was a very cool Volvo that had it was like a convertible. Okay, so made perfect sense. So as we go all through this, I'm relaxed and happy, and I'm getting good feedback signals. And then what happens is then she asked me what I drive. Which I didn't even think of. I actually don't think that much about it as a signaling device, interestingly enough. And mm-hmm. I drive a Kia Optima, which happens to be the official car of the NBA, in case people didn't know that. It's the car that Blake Griffin jumped over to win the dunk contest, as far as I'm concerned, which is, of course, why I bought the car. At any rate, and I did not get a follow-up date. So I think that she thought she was dealing with a higher socioeconomic status, more highly consumptive male, and it turned out it was sort of a beta male in a Kia. So we'll have to rethink my current strategy. All right. Onward.
So I'm curious, when you tell people the story, do they try to get you to guess their cars?
I've had that. I've had that happen quite a few times. And the guys that I used to work in front of at the prison guessed that I had a gray Camry. And actually, my Camry was at the time was bronze, so they missed by a little, but they were basically right. So it's a very interesting. I don't know what you drive. That would be sort of interesting for me to guess, but I'm not going to put myself out there on air. We'll do that.
We'll do that later.
You got it.
Because I wonder if when you go with your clients and you talk to them when you have your private sessions, are you kind of interested in having them, say, okay, let's see what kind of car you drive, make sure that they're displaying the correct, or at least displaying the personality characteristics that they actually have?
Interesting. I don't think too much about that. I might think about that, strangely enough. I might think about that if there's a guy who's struggling in the dating arena, and and we're really looking at resource displays and so on and so forth. We might actually look at that, and we've certainly looked at that a few times. I don't usually think too much about that. I simply read the cues. Most of the time I'm not too worried about what people are signaling to the world. They are signaling to me who it is that they are, and we're going to get to that very, very quickly. What we're interested in, and the only time when we might be interested in this, is when what depresses and frustrates people is when their feedback from the world is below the level of what their self-calibration mechanisms are believing that they should be able to attain. And so the discrepancy between feedback and expectation is what drives emotion. And so in the case of feedback being better than expected, that's what drives happiness. And if it's worse than expected, that's what drives depression. And so so obviously nobody comes in to report to their therapist that they're happy, for God's sakes. So everybody that walks in the door is depressed. You might not say depressed. Maybe they're anxious or upset or miserable or frustrated or angry. But the bottom line is they're not getting the feedback that they expect. That's why they're having a negative emotional response. That negative emotional response is an invaluable signal to tell them about the nature of the contrast between the feedback that they are receiving in a competitive arena versus what they expect that they should get. And those expectations aren't coming out of the blue. They are actually coming as some kind of a summed average over a graph inside their head that is connecting dots and running a multiple or a linear regression on what it is that they could reasonably expect to get based on the cues that they picked up from the environment about their competitive standing. And so you can't just snap your fingers and lower your expectations. Your expectations are automated mechanisms being derived from essentially statistical-like programs that are inside your head. So when people are unhappy, my job is to figure out why it is that their feedback is different than they think that it should be. And once in a while, it could be that that they may not be signaling appropriately with respect to conspicuous consumption. Maybe, sometimes, usually not. Usually the problem is somewhere else.
Okay.
Yeah.
Very interesting.
In my case,
okay.
I'm not so sure Alexis would made any difference, but it might have actually. I don't know. I might have been close, but no cigar.
Now, do you think, have you ever considered when someone asks, if a girl were to ask you on a date, what do you drive, to bluff and just to see what her reaction is? And then you get to the car, you're like, oh, sorry, it's a Kia, my bad. And then just watch her, to see if she's conscientious enough to, leave you because you're either lying or leave you because you're.
Yeah, actually, it's actually interesting because my attitude, obviously, as anybody who's listening to this podcast or could care less about my situation, the bottom line is that at the end of 3 hours talking to me, I kind of either qualify for day two or I don't. And I don't really think that if I drove a Rolls Royce, I'd make a hell of a lot of difference. So I'm not too worried about it. All right, let's move on to next deal.
Yeah, so the next article is actually talking about mate poaching and friendship. So mate poaching, David Buss in one of his articles defined it as behavior intended to attract someone who is already in another relationship. And the name of the article is Friendship as a Relationship Infiltration Tactic During Human Mate Poaching. So it turns out that the goals of a mate poacher, it's not just stealing away the mate, but it's also subverting the mate's current partner. So to protect against this, humans have to identify potential mate poachers and then also prevent their partner from being poached. So David Buss in 2001 did a study and he found that about over 70% of his sample reported that someone had tried to poach their mate away from them in the past. But only 50% of the people reported trying to poach someone else's mate, basically reported to be poachers.
Right.
Which to David Buss demonstrated that people have a tendency to overperceive threats to their relationship.
Oh, that's very clever of Buss. Yeah.
Yeah, okay. And then he found though that only 30% of people actually reported that their partner was successfully poached away, which he suggests that the sensitivity to being sensitive to having your partner poached may actually be a beneficial strategy.
Right, David Buss.
So,
Go ahead.
Go ahead.
Yeah, for people that don't know, David Buss is just one of the most brilliant people walking, and I believe that he is the world's leading authority on human mating behavior. He's certainly done more research and more interesting research than anybody alive, actually in all history. So this is I remember this study. I read this study years ago, and it was one of an ungodly number of different angles that Buss has looked at this problem from. And I remember some other things possibly discussed in this study or in related studies that he did. He found, for example, that an extraordinarily high percentage of very attractive people are poached out of relationships. So if you were to go to 90th plus percentile looking women, and you were to ask them how they got together with their mates, we're going to find that a hell of a lot of them were poached out of existing relationships. They largely have to be poached out of relationships because they're almost never available. Okay, as soon as a 9.5 hits the market, it's very likely that she's going to be selected out of the market pretty quickly. And so most of the time, if you are going to get a 9.5, if you have the chops to compete for one, you're going to have to steal one out of an existing relationship. So so it's going to turn out that befriending a someone who has a high-quality mate that you are interested in is one of the only avenues that people have in order to get there. I'm not just saying men do it to get women. Women do it to get men. And but this is all fascinating that Buss picks up the fact that, as you would expect of something when you are guarding something that you value, that you would expect that a degree of paranoia would be an evolved mechanism. In other words, an over-analysis of the threat. And I'm going to expect, I'm sure someday somebody's going to get a PhD from running the following analysis, and they're going to find that this is going to be true. It's going to be that the greater the objective, we could say subjective would be even more accurate, but we could objectify the difference in the mate value between the two partners. And we're going to find that the person who is significantly lower than the other partner in terms of objective mate value is going to be by far the most paranoid and have the most distortion in their assessment of poaching behavior on the part of friends, rivals, etc. So every hot chick with some guy who is significantly less hot has put up with this. That the guy thinks that every move that every guy makes anywhere near them is an effort to get at them. And the truth is that that's only true 80% of the time.
Not bad.
Yeah, that's right. So so anyway, yeah, all very good, great stuff. I'm glad you brought that to our listeners' attention. The thing that I love about David Buss is that more than just a armchair theoretician like myself, what he did for his career was he went out and actually just would grind out data to actually fill in the dots of evolutionary theory more than anybody else I've ever seen. And so he put the dots on the graph in one career to really show us, okay, this is how it works, and it works according to essentially meticulous mathematical logic that would line right up there and rival modern physics, and as it should, because ultimately what you're really talking about is DNA, and you're talking about DNA building neural circuits in such a way as to advantageously leverage themselves into the next generation, and we would expect that over 3.5 billion years of evolutionary time, that these mechanisms would be extraordinarily stereotyped and precise. And so we would find that the behavior would rarely surprise us as we would observe what it is that people are doing, and we would find that they would have some very standard operations that would be sitting inside the brain to be activated under certain conditions. And that is exactly what we find, and that's why I love reading his work.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the two hypotheses that he found to be accurate in the study was that if the poacher and the poached, if they were friends, mm-hmm. then that was more likely that it would be successful as being, you know, the mate poaching would be successful. And
right.
when they were friends, their new long-term relationship was rated as more likely to last longer than a year. So, you know, so this means we got to watch out for our potential mates as friends.
Yes, got it. All right, let's move on. What else we got going?
Well, we've got some listener questions, some emails.
Okay.
So the first one is actually about job interviewing.
Okay.
So, dear Dr. Lyle, I'd love to hear you talk about strategies for job interviewing. I was a successful pharmaceutical sales representative in the past, and I'm trying to get back into that line of work. As I've been interviewing for the past couple of years, I've realized that my ability to succeed at the job is different than interviewing for the job. So this is a highly competitive industry, so any advice or strategies you could provide would be greatly appreciated.
Sleep with the person who's making the decision. All right. So let's look at this. I'm actually joking, but I'm trying to bring home a point here that we're going to look at. We're going to try to understand the nature of what it is that we're trying to accomplish here. Now, when people interview for a job, they usually will make certain assumptions that are erroneous, and this will lead them to behavior that is not optimal for seeking the outcome that they want. So because they want to be hired by the company, then what they're thinking is they want to essentially build a virtuous cycle between themselves and the company. So when they're talking to people that are interviewing them for the job, they're basically saying, well, I really, really love your company and I do a good job for your company. Okay? So I'd be really good for your company and I really love your company. So therefore, you should love me and do good by me. Okay, that's the basic, that is exactly what you would reasonably do. And so those are the neural circuits that are firing inside the interviewee. Now, they're making a mistake. So here's the real situation. So let's paint the picture in a way that would make a lot of sense to people so that they won't forget it. Suppose you are the 55-year-old wife of a physician, and you are sort of his quasi office manager, and you're kind of getting ready to just sort of kind of halfway retire and kind of head home. You'll still look over the books, and let's suppose for the moment that you're female and your husband is the physician, and you're interviewing people for the job. So let's just figure out the number one qualification that anybody has to do the job. The number one qualification is that they not be an attractive female. That is the number one qualification for the job. Okay? So right away we see that if you are an attractive female, your odds of getting that job are zero. Okay? Not unless the woman wants to precipitate a divorce and a big crisis and an affair and a big scandal, which God knows, maybe she would want to. But the truth of the matter is all things being equal, we can see quite clearly that if the woman has a single social neuron in her head, there's no way in hell an attractive woman is getting that job. So now I want to change it up. Let's suppose you're the physician, male, whose wife is at home and is nowhere near the office, and you're interviewing for somebody the job. Now what is the highest qualification? All right. We can see clearly what the highest qualification is. In fact, if we want to make sure what the qualification is, we have the female turn around three times during the interview. Okay? Throw some pencils on the floor. We're going to see how you can pick them up. So let's look at what's happening here. When it comes to the decisions about who is hired and who is not hired, what counts is a process that we're going to call, or a dynamic that we're going to call, rapport. And what rapport is an esteem dynamic. And so it is essentially a situation where both people find that they value the other individual. If you go into Yahoo and you're going to try to get a job with Yahoo, and somebody's going to interview you, and you're thinking, well, I really want to tell them how much I want to work for Yahoo, even though I know you guys are in trouble relative to Google, I still think you're really good, and if you'll hire me, I'll do a great job for you. Okay? The person who's interviewing you couldn't give a rat's ass about Yahoo. They couldn't care less. It's in their genetic interest to figure out what is in their genetic interest. And what is in their genetic interest is, what can you do for them personally? They couldn't care less what you would do for the company. So as a result, what we have to be focused on is how to establish an esteem dynamic between you and the person who's interviewing you. And the way you're going to do that is you're going to realize that on their forehead, there's a sign hanging right there. If you look carefully, it says, I don't have enough status. Okay? Now, you might be thinking, no, that isn't true. They're behind the big desk deciding on my fate. No. They may be deciding your fate behind the desk, but in their life, they're very frustrated that they don't have enough status. Okay? Mm-hmm. So if you go on in there and you start giving Yahoo status, that doesn't give them any status. That's only the tiniest part of their identity. What's important to them is what's all about the great about them. So what we have to do in an interview is we have to essentially, I want you to think about an interview as a process of used car sales, okay? So you are trying to sell a used car, is what you're trying to do. And what we're going to do, and they are a potential buyer of the used car. So the thing is, we have to be very cool about the used car. We have to have the attitude that our car is nice and that we're confident that other people will like our car, okay? And so they, on the other hand, are trying to figure out how cheap they can get it or if they want it at all. And so we have to sing the praises of our own car, but we're also, we don't want to chase away this buyer. So we're going to be a little crafty. So let me tell you about what this dynamic would, you would want it to look like. You're going to go into the interview and you're going to have a resume. And there's going to be certain questions that they're going to, you're going to expect to ask. And in those questions, you're going to want to be professional and competent, just as you would expect. And what we're going to do is we're going to go in there in the early goings of the interview is we are going to earn esteem by a good, solid performance, okay? But the problem is, and here's what we're not going to do. We're not going to be slobbering all over ourselves telling us how excited we are about selling our car to them. Oh, my God, you saw my car? Oh, do you really like it? Oh, my God, I just see that you, I just see you in this car, okay? I can just see you in my car. I would love you to have my car.
Mm-hmm.
You're going to chase that buyer away, okay? So instead, what we want to do is we want to be professional and competent, but then somewhere in here, we are going to potentially make a self-effacing comment, okay? The reason we're going to do that is we are going, you know, if there's there's a place for it or a little bit of self-effacing humor, the reason we're going to do that is that's going to be signaling the fact that we're agreeable, okay? It's going to signal that we are not a status-hungry, competitive, elbow-throwing jerk, okay? Now, they're going to like it. We're going to watch them laugh. You have it ready, okay? So you're going to have some self-effacing humor already planned, half a dozen good self-effacing little jokes that are consistent with your answers to the 20 most common questions that you're going to get, okay? Now, those self-effacing jokes need to be good. They need to come across like they're spontaneous, even though they're absolutely planned. And then we're going to say them, and then we're going to move on. No problem. Now, this individual is going to start inferring something. In the same way that a good-looking female infers of a nice-looking guy, if he's a little bit self-effacing, they're going to infer, whoa, this guy's got a fair amount of confidence, or he wouldn't be willing to risk that status loss. Okay? He's also agreeable. He's going to be pleasant. This is a nice thing to see. Now, what's going to happen then, somewhere along the line, this person, if we've done our job, and we have enough competitive standing in this situation, that they're going to try to impress us about them, not about the company. They couldn't care less about the company. They care about themselves. And what they're going to be trying to do is they're in a position to try to understand, you know, if they're in a position of authority, it's really about what's good for them, not what's good for the company. So they're going to want to try to figure out whether you're going to be their ally, you're going to sing their praises, you're going to line up on their team, et cetera, et cetera. Okay? So what we want to do is we want to be listening for the fact that somewhere in this interview they're going to start trying to get status from us. And when they say, well, as part of this project that did such and such, here's what you don't do. Oh, my God, that's fantastic. I never would have thought of that. You're a genius. No. We don't slobber all over them. We actually are very pleasant about this, and we are we acknowledge we aren't either defensive, and we don't respond with, oh yeah, no, I did something like that too. Forget it. The thing is that if we are cool but pleasant, or I should say warm but pleasant about that, but we don't fall all over ourselves, they're going to still see that we are pleasant, capable, professional, and agreeable with our self-effacing humor, and we were not an easy sell, okay? So they're going to circle back around a little while later, and they're going to try to up the ante and try to impress you with something else. And when they do, if you see this dynamic, if it happens, listen for their specific part in the dynamic, not the whole team and how great the company was or anything else. They're going to try to get their own personal individual status. we don't bite on it the first time. I don't think that's a good strategy. But if we see it, that's fine. Be pleasant, give them a little bit of status, move on, and we continue. But then they may circle back around a little bit later, and they want more the next time. And they're going to try to up the ante to try to get more status. And then we're going to give them a lot. Okay, at this point, what we do is we got a little acting job ready, and we pause and we say, wow, that's really superb what you did. And I wouldn't have thought of that. I don't know anybody who did that. That's really cool. Okay? So now we have an authentic reaction of we are essentially selling 150% of the truth. So they're reporting something admirable. They're expecting an admiration response. But we are now going to give them an exaggerated response, not so over the top. We've already demonstrated that we're not licking anybody's shoes. Okay, so we are not a hyper signaler. But what we're going to wait for is a good, solid move on their part to try to get some status for themselves. And our job is to look for it and then land a bunch of status on them. At that point, if we played our cards carefully and well and things have broken in this fashion, in this way, then what's going to happen is we just became more valuable than our competitor that's also lining up for this job. Because they will be giving a bunch of status to the company, singing the company praises and talking about what a puppy dog they are, about how much they want to give to the company and how much they want to join this coalition. Well, our guy's already in the coalition. He's not that excited about it. If you're a member of the Oakland Raiders, you don't want somebody saying, oh my God, I'm such an incredible Raiders fan. Oh, I just love the Raiders. No. They want to know that you really admire them, that you know that they're the backup tight end and that they went to the University of Arkansas and that they were selected in the third round and that they fought their way and that they almost are being as a starter and that they're being considered as a starting level tight end throughout the National Football League and that you saw their game, you know, that they had against New Orleans about how they caught several passes and did terrific work, and a lot of commentators were talking about that. Now that guy just became your best friend. Okay, so he is not excited about you singing the praises about the Raiders. He's excited about you singing his praises. And that is your job in job interviewing, is to figure out how it is that you first must earn status by your own legitimate performance and explain to them on a nonverbal level that you are not overly excited about their company and you are not overly excited about them. And that's because they have competitors and you are a competitive human and you are under potential competitive pressure and you have options and they are not the last door in the game for you. But you are interested and you are quite interested. And so we are there with our shining face and our good prepared answers and our self-effacing humor to put our best foot forward. But then what we are watching for, like a hawk out of the corner of your eye, is the moves that the interviewer themselves will make for their own personal status. They want status from you, and we are going to cleverly give it to them. And when we do, God forbid that you are a guy interviewing with a heterosexual male for a job that the person coming behind you is a hot chick. Sorry, you won't get the job. I don't care if you went to Harvard and she went to San Diego State, okay, you are out of luck.
Better
no
hope
way.
That the interviewer is gay.
That's your only hope, okay? But the bottom line is all things being equal, what interviewers will say is, well, they're just looking for a vibe. They're going by feel, just sort of whether we had rapport, whether we hit it off. Well, what do we think that is, folks? What those are is they are feelings, and what feelings are is guidance systems, and they are guidance systems for survival and reproductive genetic advantage. So what we want to do is we want to indicate to them that it is in their genetic best interest to select us as opposed to our competitor. Okay? And so that is we go directly to their source code and hit the circuits as hard as we can hit them and that gives us the very best possible chance of competing in that situation. Okay?
Fantastic. All right. So.
All right. We'll
go. All right. So our
go
next
on to
our
the
next
one.
Email.
See what we got.
Yeah, this is from one of our listeners who's called in before. He's wondering what your thoughts are on world belief systems like religion in terms of looks and money as determiners of happiness and its influence on someone's character and personality. So the question is, dear Dr. Lyle, I'm Korean, and I'm confused about whether my genes are actually of someone who doesn't really care about resources as much as most Koreans, and so that's why I don't really want to work as hard for money as my parents would like me to. Or is it because my parents cared so much about money and looks that I'm just convincing myself that I don't care and I actually do? And somehow I find myself in the middle between my parents and the opposite of what my parents want. And somehow I'm far from my true nature in relation to wants for resources and wants for how I look physically.
Fascinating question. Okay. The there's several things going on here that we can explore, and given our time constraints, this will probably be our last question of the night, so we're going to go several minutes on this. The there are three directions for us to be thinking about here. The first of all, the notion of world belief systems, Asians, this or that, et cetera. Forget it. Everybody cares about looks and resources. The looks and resources are the two trading chips in the game of reproduction in life. So whether we are talking about aardvarks or we're talking about chimpanzees or we're talking about human beings, it's always the same problem. It's resources and looks, i.e. looks are, when we say looks, we're really talking about genes, we're talking about mutation loads, and so we're talking about essentially what sexual attractiveness are we going to be passing on to our children, which is the most important thing that you can possibly pass on to children when it comes to determining their ability to reproduce in the next generation. Okay, so that's why looks are unbelievably important, because looks are going to be unbelievably important to the next generation and to the next generation after that and to the next generation after that. That happens to be true in species that have eyes. In species that don't have eyes, they have other ways of determining mutation load and gene quality. So they'll be using other things like smell, feel, et cetera, things like that. Now, in our species, it's dominated by vision, obviously. So it's going to turn out that Korean or not Korean or anything else, everybody's unbelievably focused on looks and resources. So now we have a situation where we've got parents that are obviously highly conscientious and competitive and are worried about their son's ability to compete. Now, this makes perfect sense. So as I've said before, only in humans do humans care about the competitive prospects of their offspring. Other species simply, they just fight their own battle, they reproduce the best they can, and their job is to make sure that their children survive. If they're a pair bond species, both of them will be involved, and if they're just a regular run-of-the-mill species, only mom will be involved. But the bottom line is that essentially the parent's job is to see to it that the kid survives long enough to get to reproductive age, then it's like, good luck. Throw you the car keys and go out there and take your best shot, because I'm done. Okay, that's how it is in every other species on Earth, but not in humans. In humans, the human parent says, oh my God, I'm really worried about my kid's reproductive prospects. Okay, what can we do not to just ensure my child's survival, but ensure my child's ability to compete with all the other children who have those bitch mothers that are finagling and scheming to try to give their children a reproductive advantage. Okay, this is what's happening. Okay, so everybody's in the same game. Human beings evolve neural circuits in order to be extremely concerned about their children's competitive prospects. And certainly different parents, dependent upon their own individual differences in their own genetics about how focused they are on such things. In this case, it's going to turn out that in certain cultures are significantly different genetically than other cultures, and as a result, certain personality characteristics are more prominent in certain cultures than in other cultures. So it's no surprise, for example, and this has been this is a discussion for another day, and you know, discussion we're not going to wander into, but it is no surprise that Koreans are going to be highly conscientious. That's going to be characteristic of Northern Asians. And so that high conscientiousness, so it's no surprise that the parents are going to be highly focused on whatever variables are going to be associated with child reproductive success, and that's going to be looks and money, okay? It's not going to be as important for females to be thinking about money. It's going to be much more important for females to be thinking about looks. But if you're a boy, you better be thinking about money. So the parents are aware that in the village, whether it's a Stone Age village or it's a modern nation state and world economy, there's a thing called the dominance hierarchy. And the job of the parents is to push that child up the dominance hierarchy as far as they can push them. Okay? So highly conscientious parents, the tiger parents of our world, are push, trying desperately to get that kid as high on the dominance hierarchy as they possibly can. Okay? And the purpose of this is largely, but not necessarily entirely, but largely and sometimes entirely, it is to make sure that if your child is an 8, that child tries to snatch a 9 out of the jaws of the competitors in order so that the grandchildren are 8.5s. So in this way, if your child does that, then you have leveraged your child into having children that are superior to himself, which means you have, this is what I call winning your heat in the Darwin Derby, okay? The Darwin Derby is the circle of life that goes around and around and around, and the genes are inside the horses, and then they jump to the new horses, and then they ride around in the new horse, and then they jump to the next horse. So the horses themselves, or the people in this case, die, but the genes live. The genes are immortal. And so the genes have built the horses to run as hard as they possibly can. And so in this case, this young man's parents are doing their job as best they know it, that they are being dictated by their genes to force a highly competitive process so that their son recognizes that he is under a dire competitive process, that he must, in fact, squeeze every little bit of resources that he can get out of the world so that he can do conspicuous consumption, so that he can get a girl whose nose is just a little bit shorter than the one that he would otherwise get.
Sounds like fun. Sign me up.
Now, the reason why this got selected in evolution is because the choices in the Stone Age were very limited. So if you only had 5 girls that would have been the possible prospects, one of them was a 9, one of them was a 7, one of them was a 5, one of them was a 3, and one of them was a 1. And let's suppose you're a boy who's a 6, 7, or an 8. And you got a couple other boys that are about like you. We can see that there is enormous genetic stakes involved. Somebody's going to get the 9. Somebody's going to wind up with the 7, and somebody's going to wind up with the 5. So it makes sense to be ferociously competitive and to try to rise in every dominance hierarchy that you can. Now, if it turns out that you're a 10 boy and the next boy down is a 7, relax. Just be a lazy flake like all the really handsome people are. Okay? Like, why work that hard? We can just stroll our way in. The 9 doesn't have any choice. She's going to go for the 10. There's no rational alternative for her. Okay? So, but the bottom line is that in most Stone Age situations, this is a very tight zero-sum game. And the difference between two different slots in the equation is enormous. It can be as much as 10, 20, or 30 percentile points relative to the bell curve of human attractiveness. And so as a result, you had better co-evolve with this, with the sensitivity of being able to detect the differences between those individuals. You also have to have the ability to summon your resources and take risks in order to try to outcompete your competitors who are facing exactly the same problem that you are. Now, in the modern world, we don't have this problem because the truth of the matter is that you don't have a 9, a 7, a 5, a 3, and a 1 facing you, you have 1,000 individuals that you're going to have a shot at. And so as a result, the differences between where you're going to get to, dependent upon what you accomplish, are going to be relatively minor. Okay? Now, The so this is where this this is one reason why this young man or this whoever what his age is in some cognitive dissonance, because he can sniff that there isn't necessarily that much difference in outcomes depending upon how much he accomplishes. Now there might be, and he also has Stone Age circuits that are hearkening him and telling him that maybe he ought to get off his ass and get as many resources as possible. He also, however, has another problem, and that highly competitive parents that are highly conscientious can also set the bar too high. And when they set the bar too high, they put him in a position that his outcomes, he may detect his self calibration systems, may detect that he will his outcomes are likely to fall below their expectations. So they put him in the ego trap. Highly conscientious, highly competitive parents put their children in the ego trap. And the hallmark characteristics of the ego trap are a desire to kick over the table, not give a damn about anything, and basically display to everybody, including oneself, that I don't care about this game and I'm not even trying. So you cannot judge my underlying gene quality because I am not going to put out the effort. Okay, now this starts to sense, I'm smelling a little bit in this guy's questions and how it is that he has framed it, that I believe that he is ambivalent between his natural competitive desires, which say, you know what, I need to go get the last nickel on the table. He also can sense the ego trap, that no matter how hard he tries, he may fall short of expectations, and therefore the best way to defend himself against that status loss is to actually not try at all and to essentially demonstrate very convincingly that he is not in fact trying. Okay, that process can be not only between him and his parents, but as I've described at other times, what happens is that the internal audience also it takes cues from the outside world about what it expects of us. So his own internal audience can actually be expecting him and setting the bar for him to get off his ass and accomplish big things. And as a result, he can be ego-trapped from the inside. And so it can be that he is essentially his self. So there's three basic components of your mind, the way they work. Your mind works, your mind has a self, which is a set of self-calibration mechanisms that essentially are trying to assess what you are capable of. That is what we're going to call you. Then there's going to be an esteem meter, which is going to be a device that is sensitive to feedback from real life people about what it is that they think of your competitive displays. And so this is going to be the primary generator of your emotional life. So when other people say, wow, that was really good, then that's going to feel good. If they look like they're disappointed in your performance, it's going to feel bad. You're going to feel rejected in romance or friendship or business if you are not included into relationships that you expect to be able to compete for. And you're going to be elated when you are invited into those. And you're going to be reasonably happy when you're in relationships that you would consider that are reasonable trades for you. So that's how that's going to work. But then you also have an internal audience, which is watching you and observing you as if it's an outside people. And the reason why we have that internal audience is to help us prepare for real audiences. So that's why when you go buy a Jaguar, even though nobody's seen you in it, you can feel elated. You can feel elated because your internal audience is looking at you saying, wow, when they see you in this, they are going to be impressed. So your internal audience will send signals to your esteem meter as if it is real live people, okay? So I have a feeling it is possible that this young man not only is under ego trap pressure from his parents having too high expectations, but his internal audience also has absorbed, or those expectations have infiltrated his internal audience. And the internal audience now has the bar set pretty high. It's set just high enough that his self suspects that he cannot achieve that those levels. And as a result, his self is essentially protecting his status from both a loss of status to his internal audience and a loss of status from his parents or others by grandstanding dramatically that he is not trying. Okay? So this is, he may, in fact, probably be splitting the difference on two different strategies. Try pretty hard, but don't try all the way, and try to keep my expectations kind of down, etc. Sometimes go really push for it, etc. All the while really quite ambivalent as he feels the potential embarrassment of the ego trap of falling short of expectations should he try very hard, and also having something else involved, which is that he's not so sure this is the best way to spend his life. So a third set of problems that enters this motivational dilemma is a bright person walking through this problem with as much awareness as possible, trying to sniff a way to beat the genes. And so it's like, wait a second. I find two motivations. One of them, maybe I ought to work like hell at my looks and money to try to get as many resources as I can so that I can display as effectively as possible, so that I can get the chick whose nose is a 16th of an angstrom less asymmetrical than the other one. Okay? That's one strategy. That's the ancient strategy of the genes. Second strategy of the genes is, oops, the village put the bar too high, therefore I need to defend my status, because if I think I'm going to fail at this process, then the right move is to back off and demonstrate that I'm not even trying. That's a brutal position to be in. That's the ego trap, and that feels really bad, but it also has a safety factor in there, but this is potentially creating some serious cognitive dissonance. If the person is depressed, frustrated, even has suicidal fantasies, is angry, if those are emotional reactions to this person, then it's an ego trap problem. Okay. The third part is that he could be sniffing around all through all of this and basically saying, you know what, I'm not so sure that everybody else, including my internal audience and my parents, has analyzed this problem accurately. And I just have a sense that maybe this, I shouldn't be in the Darwin Derby writing as hard as I can, okay, and trying to figure it out. And so that is how I sort of see this person's dilemma. And hopefully this may have stirred a little bit of curiosity in this individual. And if you're interested, I have videos that I have done on John McDougall's website on self-esteem issues. One of them is called Stepping Stones for Self-Esteem. It's a webinar that I did. Another one is called Dare to be Lousy, and another one is called The Slow Fast Way. Those are three different, I think I did another one called something, I can't remember, Esteem Dynamics possibly. So they're not great. There's little slideshows. They explain a lot of these internal dynamics. But one of the fallout that comes from this is that the place that we want to be is we want to acknowledge that we're in a competition. And we want to acknowledge that it's our job to do a very good job putting a good foot forward, not our best foot forward, because we're not going to – it's silly to spend so much of our energy on these competitions when there's an awful lot of other ways to activate the moods of happiness. I could make more money and be more famous and have, you know, that Jaguar that I should have if I did not spend as much time as I do. God bless you, Nate. Thank you so much for saying that. The deal is that the deal is that I love petting my cats. Okay? I have three cats. Two of them are good friends, and the other poor one is just such a sourpuss that she can't interact with the other two, and she's lonely. So the truth is that I have great joy every day petting my cats, and I love that sort of oxytocin cycle that goes on between myself and the cats that is so well documented by Paul Zak in a book called The Moral Molecule, a highly, highly recommended book that I may not have talked about before. But really, these processes of love that go on in mammals and obviously some other animals and, you know, very much in humans, these are wonderful experiences, and we want to enjoy them. And if we are caught up and get trapped by our genes in a furiously competitive process where all of the energy is being directed towards how much money, how much looks, how fancy can we demonstrate who it is that we are, then unfortunately what will happen is our life gets out of balance. And we are now not going to enjoy our life as much as it could have been enjoyed. So I have a feeling that this young man is sniffing the confusion of probably three different major perspectives on how to best live his life. And so this is the ego trap, straight competitive pressure, as well as the truth about how would be the most insightful and most rewarding way to spend one's existence. And it's going to mean that the best way is to fight very hard to keep out of the ego trap, because we don't need self-destructive grandstanding that we're not trying. We want to try. We want to compete. We want to do a good job at competition so that we are prepared and ready for the time when we may be in situations where we may be able to actually secure mates, friends, or trading partners that would be excellent to add to our existence. But along the way, we want to have a life with some balance in it, where we are not we are not essentially letting the competitive chip inside of our head run amok. Okay, it would not have run amok in the Stone Age, because you would not have an infinite amount of dominance hierarchies that you could continue to climb. And so in the Stone Age, what we have is we've got a hill climbing chip inside of our brains that got put in an environment of which you could have spend your entire life trying to climb to the top of the dominance hierarchy. In the Stone Age, we wouldn't have had that. And so we would have naturally had a better balance between friendship, between economic process, and a variety of different kinds of displays, family, kids, et cetera, as well as romance. So we would not have been singularly focused on something as narrow as just our looks and our resources. And so as a result, the modern environment can easily get people out of balance, in trouble, and then insightful and tortured souls wind up questioning the whole thing. And, you know, winding up in various spiritual and intellectual journeys trying to figure this mess out. And hopefully tonight I've shed a little bit of light on what I think the nature of these conflicts are. And a reasonable approach is not to kick over the table and try to pretend like we are, you know, some yogi on a mountainside who doesn't care. No, that's not who you are. You are competing for the sexual interests of other people. That is going to require that you do a good job. But you don't have to invest your whole life in it, and we don't have to set the bar that we're supposed to get as, quote, high in the world as we possibly could get. If we do that, we will sacrifice a great deal of very rewarding experiences along the way.
Fantastic. All right. This is great.
All right.
So final thing here. This is a couple of patients of mine. They told me that it's an elderly couple. They went into their doctor and they told the doctor that they're having some trouble with their sex life. And they asked the doctor, could you watch and then offer us some suggestions? The doctor says, I'm not a sex therapist. You should find someone else. He said, no, we trust you. If you could just please. And he says, okay, fine. So he watched them have sex, and he says, you know, you don't seem to be having any troubles. I actually wish my sex life was just as good. I can't really give you any suggestions. So they came back the next week and the third week and the fourth week. After they finished on the fourth week, the doctor said, listen, you're not having any trouble at all. Is this your idea of kinky sex? And the man said, no, actually, the problem is if we have sex at my house, my wife will catch us. And if we have sex at her house, her husband will catch us. The motel charges $50. We can't afford that, but you only charge $35 and Medicare pays for half of it. Speaking of mate punching.
Very good. Fine work for an evolutionary show. Love it. Good job, Nate.
All right. Have a good night, Dr. Lau.
Thanks for listening. If you like what you hear, subscribe, write us a review, or share this podcast with a friend. To send in a question or read more about the show, you can visit our website at www.beatyourgenes.org. Until next time, this is Nate G. and Dr. Lyle with Beat Your Genes, an evolutionary psychology podcast for finding happiness in the modern world.